ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID, the Future, we hear Dr. Stephen C. Meyer, author of the fantastic new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. He's talking here today with radio host Mark Bernier from WNDB in Daytona Beach, Florida. It's a wide-ranging conversation, including even the question of extraterrestrials.
This is a topic that we have not talked about. We've kind of talked around it, but we have never done an actual interview on the subject. It has great importance. It is a very serious topic, and it's the subject of God and hypothesis. The New York Times bestselling author of Darwin's Doubt presents a groundbreaking scientific evidence of the existence of God based on breakthroughs in physics, cosmology, which we've talked about that subject. We even did a whole town hall on it at Embry-Riddle, and biology. And I remember asking the question, can you have a true belief in God and believe in science? To talk about his new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, is the author, the best-selling author himself, Stephen C. Meyer, who joins us live today on WNDB. Stephen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Mark, for having me on. It's a pleasure.
There are often people who believe that they have to abandon their faith if they embrace the science. How do you marry the two together?
Well, I think the short answer is by looking at the evidence rather than listening to public spokespersons for science, often self-appointed spokespersons who are actually advocating not for science, but for scientific atheism or the worldview known as scientific materialism. And in the new book that you kindly introduced, Return of the God Hypothesis, I look and examine three key scientific discoveries that have been made over the last century. The first is that the universe, the physical or material universe, had a definite beginning. The second discovery is that from the beginning, the universe in its fundamental physical parameters has been, against all odds, finely tuned to allow for the possibility of life, to generate a life-conducive universe. And thirdly, and perhaps most dramatically of all, when we examine the inner workings of even the simplest living cells, scientists have found digital information and a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that mirrors our own high-tech digital computing technology, but exceeds it in its integrated complexity. And these three discoveries together, I argue, point not just to a designing intelligence, but to a designing intelligence that must transcend the universe, be capable of structuring the whole of the universe to make it life-friendly, and yet also an intelligence which is active in the universe, in the creation since the beginning. So not a deistic creator, not a space alien, but something very much akin to what traditional Jews and Christians have always thought of as God.
Stephen, I want to share something with you. About 5 years ago at Embry-Riddle, I interviewed a cosmologist who was from the Vatican, and he wrote a book called Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? And it's a big question. It sounds like a funny title, but we had a very serious discussion about how a living God, how a God we believe in as Christians, would handle the situation of aliens and extraterrestrials. As so many people believe, we cannot be the only intelligent life out there. Is it possible, do you think, that extraterrestrials might be believing in the same God?
C.S. Lewis wrote an interesting space trilogy in which he speculated about the possibility of other intelligent life forms on another planet who had not rebelled against God. I suppose, given the vastness of the universe, it is possible that we might find life in some other part of the universe. However, the assumption that this would be highly probable, that was very common among scientists even a generation ago, I think has become much less of a popular hypothesis or much less commonly held, precisely because the number of parameters that have to be just right, both at the cosmological level and at the biological level, in order to produce even a simple living cell, is just mind-boggling. And so when you run the numbers on this, it used to be thought, well, there's so many planets, so many star systems, so many galaxies, it's inevitable that things would arise somewhere. And yes, there, that means there's a lot of opportunities. But the number of the improbability, which would be sort of the denominator, is so vast that even with all those possibilities, it looks like life in the universe is extremely rare. And there are two great astronomers at the University of Washington, Don Brownlee and Peter Ward, who wrote a book a few years back called Rare Earth, and another book in the wake of that called Privileged Planet has underscored that same sort of perception. So it's an open question, but I think the idea that life is inevitable just because there's a lot of galaxies doesn't really take into account how improbable the many parameters are that need to be set just right to make life possible, even in its simplest form.
Stephen, was it in the late 19th century that a lot of intellectuals started to insist that science and belief in God are at war, or did that start much earlier?
No, that is right about the time when this this myth of the warfare between science and belief in God, or between science and Christianity, arose. There was two famous books, but one by the title The History of the Warfare Between Science and Christianity. And these were written by revisionist historians in the late 19th century, in the immediate wake of Darwin, Marx, Huxley, and then later Freud, the great thinkers of the late 19th century who helped formulate the consensus that we inherited in the 20th century, the philosophical consensus, which scholars give the name scientific materialism. And that was a great, that perspective was represented a huge departure from the way the framework, the worldview or philosophical framework that had inspired science and guided science from its modern inception. When historians of science look back to the period they call the Scientific Revolution, from roughly 1500 to 1750, they find that not only did this occur within a religious context in Western Europe, a Judeo-Christian religious context in Western Europe, but the thinkers and the early scientists were investigating nature in a particular way for explicitly religious reasons. The great historian of science at Baylor University, Rodney Stark, has written a tremendous book called For the Glory of God with Princeton University Press about this period of scientific history. So the 19th century was indeed a departure from the long-standing theistic framework that had existed for doing science. And the story of my book is the story of the discoveries that are bringing that framework back, that are showing that the postulation of a transcendent, intelligent creator actually provides the best explanation of the key evidences that we now have about cosmological and biological origins.
Stephen, I'm always curious about advances in medicine. If one believes in God, that we are possessed with an ability to learn about things, that God provides the opportunities, there is an ethical issue that comes in, and I'm not sure how we're supposed to handle this. Just because we can do something, should we do it? And I'm wondering how God and hypothesis is going to enter into this as we learn new ways to handle medical procedures, preserve life, as opposed to allowing people to die through a natural death. How do we handle that in the future?
Oh, that's a really perceptive question, and an important thing to think about, because in the framework of what's called scientific materialism, if you believe that all there is fundamentally is matter in motion, Richard Dawkins has said the universe has exactly the properties that we should expect if there is at bottom nothing, no design, no purpose, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. If the universe is indifferent to our concerns and to moral considerations generally, and if the purpose of science is to study such a strictly materialistic system, then there can be no basis for an objective ethic or ethics. And ethics become merely a matter of subjective preference. They become relative. And so whatever a given scientist wants to do may be the only consideration. What a scientist wants to do may be the only consideration in whether or not he or she pursues a given line of research. But if, on the other hand, you believe that human beings are made by a purposive creator with special value, then you have to think carefully about how you pursue scientific research so that you don't efface the dignity of those human beings. And of course, we only need to go back to the great totalitarian experiments of the 20th century, Soviet Union, the Soviet Communism, and especially Nazi Germany, where science was abused and people were used as experimental subjects as if they had no intrinsic value, but were rather just a matter, just a part of the grand materialistic system that we call the universe. So I think what you're hitting on something very important. I don't in the book get into the ethical issues, but I do discuss the whole question of meaning and whether you can have any sense of transcendent meaning, any confidence in the reliability of the mind. The God hypothesis not only explains some of the scientific evidence that we have, the important scientific evidence we have about origins, but it also grounds our confidence in the reliability of the mind and our grounds any search that we might have for ultimate meaning beyond the short time that we're here on Earth.
Stephen, I know that in addition to being an author, you've been a former educator. And my question is, how do we handle this subject of intelligent design within our schools? I know a lot of people are afraid of it. A lot of people say no. How do we handle that?
Well, it really shouldn't be a terrifying subject because after all, and here again, I very much appreciate the persons opposite in this debate, the new atheists and the neo-Darwinists, especially those that have been most vociferous in making their arguments, because they do a great job of framing the key issues. And in biology, Richard Dawkins has done a great job of that when he said that, in his view, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Of course, the key word for him and other neo-Darwinists is the appearance of design. But if the evidence might support the concept of the appearance of design, it's also possible that it might support the reality of design. And that's an interesting debate. Now, that's the debate between neo-Darwinism and the theory of intelligent design. It's not as if the question of design is imported into biology by people who have no interest in biology. It's been part of the discussion in biology from Aristotle to Darwin and right to the present. Francis Crick even said that the modern biologists have to constantly remind themselves that what they're looking at was not design, but rather evolved. So this appearance of design is very striking. The question, is it real or is it an illusion? And that's a subject I think can certainly be taken up in any college biology classroom where professors have guarantees of academic freedom. The problem right now is that at the K through 12 level, to bring that up invites litigation. And we've not been pressing that our theory of intelligent design be addressed at that level, because at this point we want to win the argument, or at least prosecute a compelling argument that merits consideration at the highest levels of science. So at the university level, we think it's a great thing to discuss. At the K through 12 level, we've been advising biology teachers say, yes, teach the arguments for Darwinian evolution in its contemporary form, but also teach the counter arguments as they are now being expressed by leading biologists, including evolutionary biologists, in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. There's plenty of doubts about neo-Darwinism in the scientific literature, and exposing students to some of those skeptical doubts and evidential problems is enough to blunt the indoctrination that sometimes occurs in the public school system.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's the director of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, and he's the author of a new book that we're talking about here. Stephen, I've always been a fan and a believer in Dennis Prager, and about 2.5 years ago, you had an interview with him. He had been agnostic on evolution, but reading and talking with you kind of changed his mind. Can you share with us what that exchange was like?
Well, Dennis is a terrific guy, as you know, and a deep thinker. And we had, I had an interview with him about Signature in the Cell, my first book, then another about Darwin's Doubt. Soon after, or maybe soon before the second one, I got to know him a bit in person, and his wife and my wife and Dennis and I got together as a foursome and had some very deep conversations. His wife Sue is very interested in these topics and was reading very deeply on it. And I know they were having conversations, and I think Dennis just took some time to look at the evidence. And he's a steel trap, and it didn't take him long to realize that the kind of official line on this that we all get from public television shows and the pronouncements of groups like the National Academy of Sciences or the AAAS were more propaganda than justified science. So I recently did an interview with him about the new book and on his Ultimate Issues Hour, and we had a terrific conversation again. And since then, I've also done a PragerU episode about the mathematical problems associated with neo-Darwinism and the problem of something is increasingly acknowledged by leading even evolutionary biologists, and that is that the mutation selection mechanism lacks the creative power to generate the new biological information, the genetic information that's necessary to build new forms of life. Mutation typically degrades information. It doesn't create it. And so the main mechanism of evolutionary variability or variation seems to be inadequate to what we now understand about what makes life tick. And the PragerU people invited me to do a 5-minute video on that, and that's up on their site. You can watch it. We've had millions of views of it. So we've had a very nice relationship with both with Dennis and his show, but also the fantastic series they do with the short videos on topics across the range of interesting subjects from history to philosophy to science and politics. So he's terrific. I agree.
And, you know, for Dennis, I understand it wasn't any religious concerns. It was the science. Now he has another understanding. Stephen, does one have to abandon their deep faith, particularly Christian? And any element do they have to abandon if they're going to embrace intelligent design?
No, just the opposite. I would think that intelligent design is in a way presupposed in the great theistic religious traditions, because if God is an active creator who did something to bring the universe into existence and to structure matter and energy within the universe to create things like galaxies, planets, and especially living organisms, then any action of an agent, of an intelligent agent, to produce some specific outcome is a form of intelligent design. So intelligent, the question that more commonly arises is, can you be a believer in evolution and believe in God? And of course, there are people who are theistic evolutionists, but that's been a difficult position to hold, because the Darwinian version of evolution denies that there is any intelligence involved in guiding the evolutionary process. So reconciling those two things, I think, has been much more difficult than reconciling intelligent design and theistic belief. I would say that intelligent design has clear theistic implications. And in this new book, I address those implications head on to show that if we look not only at the evidence that we have in biology, but also bring in the evidence from physics and cosmology, we've got very powerful evidence, not just for a designer of some unspecified kind, but of a designer who must have transcended the physical universe and been capable of structuring the whole of the universe, giving it its origin and its fine-tuning, as well as being responsible for subsequent infusions of information into our biosphere that have made new forms of life possible.
I'm curious if, as the human body ages and we live longer or we discover new ways to extend our life, is that part of intelligent design as well? The ability to comprehend and put into practice those things that extend life?
Well, certainly we use our own powers of agency to design everything from internal combustion engines to French recipes to digital code in the computer environment, but also to devise prophylactic measures and medical cures for diseases, and all of those things are helping to extend human life. So I think that's part of, in a religious context, that's sometimes referred to as part of the creation mandate, that human beings are to exercise their dominion over the creation for the good of themselves and also for the other creatures that God has created. So absolutely. It's interesting, by the way, that public opinion polling of medical doctors has shown them in a sizable majority consistently skeptical about the neo-Darwinian account of biological origins. They simply see too much integrated complexity, too much evident design. The logic of physiological systems is so obviously palpable to anyone who's been through med school that many, many doctors are sympathetic to the case for intelligent design. In fact, I often share that the people that are most instinctively get our arguments for intelligent design are medical doctors, software engineers, and then of course mechanical and electrical engineers as well. So people who work with design systems are quick to understand the indicators of design that we're finding in the biological realm.
Finally, I want to ask about a quote. This is attributable to you. You said, "The heart cannot exalt in what the mind rejects." Pretty deep. Stephen, can you explain that to me?
Yeah, when I was a professor, I had a long, tortuous religious conversion. It was about something like 7 years. I had so many questions and was overthinking everything. And I always had a particular sympathy for students who were geared that way, and they would somehow or other find me. And I was in a philosophy and philosophy of science department, and I ended up offering a course called Reasons for Faith because I find it tragic. I mean, you look at the polling data we have today. The pollsters are tracking a group they call the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated agnostics and atheists. And there's been a precipitous rise in the number of religiously agnostic and atheistic young people in the 18 to 30-ish cohort. And when you probe that group, the number one reason often offered for either walking away from faith in God or not considering it is no scientific evidence. And in fact, 2/3 of young atheists say that the findings of science make the existence of God less likely. Well, I think the case is exactly the opposite. It's why I wrote this book, but I used to teach a course that I called Reasons for Faith. And I encountered many, many students who never really they had a conversion of some kind, but it was based on subjective feelings oftentimes. And they would get to university, they'd get challenged by professors who were operating out of a more materialistic or atheistic framework, and they would quickly lose their faith because they couldn't answer the intellectual objections and questions that were being posed to them. And I used to warn students that singing praise songs or feeling having a subjective awareness of God's presence, as true and reliable as that might be. I mean, I don't discount the instinctive awareness that many people have of God, but people can get talked out of that if they're confronted with intellectual arguments and scientific arguments that they can't answer. And so I used to warn them, the heart cannot, and maybe we could add the word continue to exalt in what the mind rejects. Eventually, that cognitive dissonance will erode the faith of one's youth. And so it's very important to think through these issues and have reasons for what you believe, not just to adopt a belief on the basis of a subjective experience or on the basis of what perhaps your family always believed.
Dr. Stephen C. Meyer is the New York Times bestselling author of Return of the God Hypothesis, 3 scientific discoveries that reveal the mind behind the universe. Dr. Meyer, it's been a real honor to have you on our program today. And we want to direct listeners to his website, returnofthegodhypothesis.com. You can purchase the book there and just about everywhere. Dr. Meyer, thank you for a fascinating discussion, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Hey, you too, and thanks for the great questions and a really good conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day. Bye now.
Yep. Bye-bye.
That was Stephen C. Meyer in a radio interview with Mark Bernier of WNDB Radio, Daytona Beach, Florida. Tune in to ID of the Future for more great conversations on intelligent design. I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.